So how was that for awkward? All right. Anyway.
No, you nailed that. That was perfect.
Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winsenberg and me, Stephen Jones. Today we will be joined in the second half by Professor James Willits to discuss remembering, heroes, and race. So what's been a highlight for you this week?
This week, a highlight for me has been related to students. I had a chance to meet with a student on Zoom this week. We were doing some sort of mentoring meetings, you know, during the semester, and it's been interrupted from having to move now to this virtual learning. That was just refreshing, being able to touch base with him again. And then last night, Jonathan Vincent and I, you know, we co-teach this class. He's a communications professor at Crown. We co-teach this class on film and theology. And we were having our class last night live. And afterwards, we were just reflecting back on our experience with the students. And it was hard in a lot of ways to think about some of the graduating seniors that we won't be seeing in class again. But it also brought me a lot of joy just to think about some of the conversations we've had in that class and then in other classes. And then I reminded myself, I'm like, man, I had Jonathan Vincent in class 10 years ago.
As your student.
Yeah, he went from, you know, being a student of mine to then now that we're working together. And like, that's part of the joy is like not just seeing our students move on, but also potentially, you know, intersecting and seeing them again in the future in different contexts. It's great in a lot of ways. So that brought me a lot of happiness and joy just thinking about that as much as it was sad to reflect on our seniors who will be leaving. It's such a weird experience, isn't it, that we get interaction with these folks for 4 years. And then after that, yeah, it's like, you know, we're trying to maintain connections and whatnot. But in some ways, it's really cool just to think back on a lot of the conversations we were able to have. How about for you?
I think for me, I had a moment where I realized that we have most of what we need, and that's been true for this whole quarantine thing. Like, for example, Jenny made a Costco run before all of this happened, actually to help a friend out with something. And they ended up not having anything the friend needed, you know.
Oh, no.
But because of that, we had toilet paper and we had flour and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think pausing to realize like, oh, we have most of what we need. Even for the business, there were some system stuff that we had bought to set up. I mean, there's always more that I would, you know, could use, but that we have most of what we need. And that's been really encouraging. And then also last night we had a Zoom call with some of our extended family. And I've heard people talking about how that's really wearing. I loved it. It was really fun. So that was good.
Yeah, you know, it's not as good as being in person, right? But in some ways, the nice thing is it's better than just like emailing or texting or even talking on the phone because you get to see everyone's faces.
Right.
So how about for a low light?
For a low light for me, I think a low light for me, so I'm changing my role at the college next year, which I've talked to some of the students about, and I'll still be involved with teaching some classes and whatnot, but not in the same role I've been in. And it hit me Friday, because Friday was the last day of class. And it just was overwhelming, just this feeling of like, I don't know where I fit next year. Like there's this whole thing that happens sometimes called role deprivation, where you move out of the role you've been in and you don't know then what your new role is. And I knew that would happen at some point. I just didn't expect it to be Friday. Just really, I don't know. And then with that, not being able to say a proper goodbye to graduating students, one of my students, I was contacted by a family member asking if I'd write a little graduation speech for the student who's graduating, which I'm going to do. I think I'll record it and
that's cool
and send it. But it made me really sad though, because I was like, oh, I don't get to say the goodbyes, don't get to meet the families, you know, all these things that are part of that ritual, which I don't necessarily enjoy that ritual usually, but I didn't realize some of the purposes it was fulfilling. And so I'll miss those.
Well, and you already know my thoughts on your role change, at least us just feeling some sense of sadness on my part of not having all the same time together that we normally do. But I'm also excited we get to teach class together in the fall. So
that's, yes, I'm excited about that too.
And I'm also excited for you just for what your future might look like and all of that. So it's kind of bittersweet, isn't it? Like on the one hand,
it is
sad, and on the other hand, exciting.
Yeah. So what's been a low light for you this week?
Yeah, I made a little bit of a blunder online this week. I'd been given some graduation money for my PhD program, and I'd done a bunch of research on a creative way that I could use that money. And so I had this plan of something that I wanted to get, and I found a way to make it to where I could save some money by purchasing some gift cards for this site at a discount rate, and then, you know, using it that way. And then I found out that the gift cards I purchased, I couldn't use on the site that I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And so it created this hurdle. And what's odd is it's such a minor thing in a lot of ways, but what was such a low light is it kind of spiraled my anxiety in a lot of ways, not just related to that little bit of a online, you know, blunder.
So hold on. So you bought gift cards, and then so they're legit gift cards, but you can't use them?
Correct. Well, they're legit gift cards. But what I found out was that I can't actually use it on the website that I thought I could use it on.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So it was for a different website, even though the company is related. And so it led to this kind of me having these gift cards now that I can't use for what I wanted to use them for.
Oh, that's frustrating.
And it's in the big scheme of life. Yeah. In the big scheme of life, it's a small thing. And Jill reminded me, she's like, well, sometimes you got to think, you know, like, is this little moment that's happening right now, is this really going to matter to me like a year from now? You know, and it won't. But what it did is it put me into this spiral of anxiety. Like, it's so bizarre in some ways. And I've talked about this, you know, on the podcast before, but it's been something I've had to now manage here over the last couple of days, just thinking about what to do with this anxiety that I have kind of lingering. And it's not just related to the online thing. It's also related to some other things going on. And I just find myself in these old thought patterns where I just have this strong sense that something really bad is going to happen and that it's out of my control. And even though my brain says, now, come on, you're overdoing this, you know, like, this is such a minor thing in the world, but my emotional capacity can't convince myself that that's true,
right?
Which leads to the insight.
Well, all right, let's hear it.
Yeah, so the first insight is, you know, read the fine print when you're buying gift cards online. the second insight is actually being in these sort of spirals of anxiety has brought me back into places in the scriptures that I haven't been looking at a lot lately. For example, the Psalms. I do not naturally gravitate towards the Psalms. In fact, it's probably one of the least likely places that I would gravitate towards, and not necessarily for any reason, but sometimes I think we view the Psalms as these like just subjective musings that really, you know, can't give us anything solid about who God is. But what I'm finding now is that it's like the subjective experiences of these human beings in the past who've experienced God and wrestled with God that has provided me the most comfort in the midst of my own anxieties. So I've gone to places like Psalm 77, where the psalmist, you know, is crying out to God for help in distress. And then he's like, and I remembered you, God, but his remembrance of God didn't cause him comfort. It caused him to groan, as if like, I remembered you. And then I reminded myself about how absent you feel in the midst of this.
How about that?
Yeah, it's this crazy thing. And then the most comforting part for me, though, is the psalmist starts questioning God's love and whether his mercy will ever reappear again. And then it leads him to this conclusion where it's like, but here's what I'll appeal to. I'll appeal to the old days when you stretched out your mighty hand and you did these amazing works. And it reminds me a lot actually of Habakkuk, where Habakkuk starts out similarly, where we get this kind of cry for help from Habakkuk. And then we get that incredible statement where it says, where God is saying, for I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you. Mm. And we often read that as like, oh, God's doing something remarkably good for us. But in Habakkuk, the remarkable thing God's doing is sending the Babylonians to judge his own people.
Well, how about that?
And this leads
Habakkuk. Oh, wow. There's a hermeneutical leap that we make in there.
Exactly. Yeah. That's not at all talking about what we think it is. And then Habakkuk in like chapter 2, he basically is like, I'm going to set myself up on this watchtower to see how God will respond to my complaint. And this leads to this like oracles of all these woes. But the conclusion of Habakkuk is similar to Psalm 77, where then we get this prayer like in chapter 3, where Habakkuk is like, man, I've heard the reports of what you've done, God. Now do it again. Like in the days of old, those things that you did for your people, like, do them in our day now. I don't know. I've just been reflecting on all this anxiety I've been having. And I remember Glenn Myers, you know, he's a professor of church history and New Testament and theology at Crown. He said to me once when I was a student, like, don't question the things in the dark that you know is true in the light. Mm. So what he's kind of getting at is that, like, there's this moments that we have of darkness and anxiety or whatnot, where our brain is just taking us to all these places, and like rest and reside in the things that you know are true in God's goodness and in the good old days kind of thing. In some ways, that's Habakkuk and that's the Psalm. So it's a bit of a long insight, but I'd have to say, man, just going back to these passages have been very comforting for me in the midst of anxieties where my mind's just taking me all over the place.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We were just in Psalm, I think it was 66 this morning, and it was talking about, it has this language of, you led us into a trap, right?
Yeah.
but it's out in this whole process of being refined as silver, you know, which is actually a violent process. But then it has this thing of, but then you led us through the fire, you led us through water, and into this place of abundance. And then we were talking about how the place of abundance is not necessarily what we sometimes imagine it to be. Yeah. And the risk even of pursuing abundance instead of pursuing Christ. And my insight for this week, I think I've been wrestling with this whole Ahmaud Arbery thing. And I, obviously it's terrible, but I think what I'm specifically wrestling with is trying to think through, I've noticed all of these people that I feel like have mostly been silent on issues of race, talking about the Ahmaud Arbery situation, posting about it. You know, it seems to be maybe some virtue signaling or other things. And I feel really self-conscious making any critiques of that, because I'm reminded of Macklemore's White Privilege 1 and White Privilege 2 videos. I don't know if you've seen those, or it's their songs, you know, but it's his wrestling, right, with where do I fit with all this, and recognizing his own privilege in the midst of it. I'm also reminded of Jesus' instruction to remove the log from your own eye before you, you know, try to help somebody else with the splinter in their eye. But I don't know. I feel like this sudden outpouring of support and indignation. I'm just like, is it genuine? Like, because it almost feels like people were surprised. You know, we shouldn't expect things like that to happen, right? But if you pay attention to what Black folks in America are saying, this fits with the pattern that we're in. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is our racial history. This is who we have been as a country. And so to suddenly be like, oh, I can't believe this thing happened, and not really have noticed that this is the trajectory you're on. Does that make any sense?
It does. Yeah. And it's so complex in some ways. I remember, was it a quote that you told me about that said something like, racism is in America's DNA?
I have heard that quote. I don't think that.
I don't know who that's from, but I did hear Don Cheadle, though, on LeBron James's show, The Shop. It's a bunch of guys sitting around a barbershop having conversations. Don Cheadle said something along the lines of, like, racism is America's birth defect. And in some ways, it's like, when we have this deeply inrooted historical experience of racism, it's so difficult to sift through these sorts of issues in modern times, even if we feel like some of the blatant racism was more existent in the past. Of course, that's just a perception in a lot of ways, but the fact that it's part of our DNA and it's maybe our birth defect makes it very difficult to converse about these things. What was the word that you used? Virtue? The phrase you used?
Virtue signaling?
Virtue signaling. I've never heard that before. Is that the idea then, that like people are just basically trying to post in order to make themselves look good?
That would be the cynical view of it, right? I think that there's also sometimes this hope that maybe by posting certain things, you let people know, hey, this is what I care about.
I see.
And so that it wouldn't have to be cynical, but I think there is often that kind of the sense of it. Hey, you know what?
We have a guest with us.
We do.
We'll be back in a moment with James Willits.
I'm really excited to have with us today James Willits, who did graduate studies in history and education at the University of Wales in Cardiff. He's focused on history and international politics and teaches history at Crown College in Minnesota.
Can I just say that I'm a little bit jealous, because I think after all this education I've done, I'm like, if I could go back and do it over, I think I'd do history. Like, history is just so exciting. So to have a historian with us, I'm excited to have you today.
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you very much for having me on.
So, James, a couple of times I've had the privilege of joining you in one of your classes to talk about things related to race. And I thought that might be an interesting place to start. Today, we were just talking about Ahmaud Arbery and how do we think well about some of these things. And I was just, what I'm wondering about is, so recently the Atlanta mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, said that his killing was a lynching. And that got me to thinking about how much, I'm just wondering, like, how familiar are Americans actually with our racial history? Because lynching means something really significant, right? There's this whole history around that. And I'm just wondering, like, what have you observed as you've been teaching American students, right? So you studied American history as a non-American. And now as you have come in and been teaching Americans, like, what do we know about ourselves?
I think that what I have picked up from teaching American history is that actually most Americans, I think, are painfully unaware of a lot of the deeper stuff within American racial history. I think that most Americans have a surface level understanding. They have an understanding of there was a history of slavery, that the Civil War in some way responded to that and righted some of the worst excesses of that. And then there is kind of a gap that most students seem to have between the end of the Civil War and the Reconstruction era, and if they even have that much of an understanding of Reconstruction, which then kind of leads up into the 1950s, 1960s civil rights movement and then disappears again. And so there are these large sections of American history that have significant racial disquiet, significant racial movements, significant racial problems within them that are either completely overlooked or ignored because they don't fit into the larger narrative, which is things are getting better. And things have been getting better consistently, and things have been getting better in what is a very clear upward trajectory. And so some of the times that you have been sat in on my classes have been attempts to kind of try and redress some of that upward curve theory of history, which is that simply we're always pointing upwards and that as we continue on, things will continue to get better without really much in the way of any help. One of the things that I've really noticed about American history is that there are some fundamental misunderstandings about how history works, both as a discipline and in terms of past events leading to one another. And that can mean that kind of, I think one of the things is that people believe that either racial issues are A, in the past, we've dealt with them already, we can move on from that stuff. That B, that those racial issues are caused by bad racist people, but that generally society as a whole is pretty good and doing pretty well.
Right. That's a pretty popular narrative.
Yeah. So the idea that, you know, there are just bad apples, that even today, you know, racism is a problem for certain people who hold very obvious, overt racist beliefs, but that otherwise we're doing pretty good. They're just isolated cases. And that finally, see, things have got better. So why are people still complaining? And certainly, why are they complaining in the way that they're complaining? Can't they just do something in a little bit more calm, measured manner?
I remember in 2009, I was teaching cultural anthropology, and we have a section where we deal with race and ethnicity. And so Obama had just won the presidency. And I remember my class, many of the students in my class being like, well, I mean, racism is done, right? So why are we even talking about this?
Yeah. And that worked out perfectly, as we can now say. So I think that those three together are a very common narrative for today, but they do bleed back into history.
So can I say the three back to you? I want to make sure I caught them.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So one was that there's this upward trajectory, that it's kind of everything is moving upward. The second is that there are bad apples, but that overall things are better. And then the third is that it's basically resolved. Is that it?
So it's in the past. There are some bad racist people, but generally people are good and not racist. And that because of that, it's been resolved, and further complaints or further efforts to address this are maybe either unnecessary or going too far. The going too far thing seems to be a more modern idea, except then you can take it back historically and you can see people who are using these arguments in the 1950s and 1960s, in the 1930s, in the 1880s, further back than that even, and are having these conversations saying, actually, we're on this upward trajectory and it's only a few people and actually the majority of people are good, or why are we still having this conversation? We've already dealt with slavery. Why do we need to do anything beyond that?
I remember in 2001 and 2002, in the summers of those years, I spent some time on a reservation out in Nevada, and that really opened my eyes up to some of the racial components that were present in American history that I had overlooked. Thinking about Manifest Destiny and westward expansion and some of the narratives I was given when I was in high school and junior high about, you know, some of the glorious portraits of these, you know, settlers moving west without even considering a lot of the genocide that took place. Like, how do you think as a historian we rewrite history in a way that tries to balance out some of the unhelpful narratives that we're given that don't tell the full picture, as if we really can ever tell the full picture, but that just balances it out in ways, especially in American history, where we've tried to erase some of the truth of the racism that's been present in our history.
I would say it's not just American history. You know, as a Brit, I would say that we have a long history of erasing both other cultures' achievements and also our own negative impact. I would say that Britain has got better at dealing with that since decolonization and the end of the empire. Britain, I think, has had a national reckoning about its role in the world, but that still definitely isn't fully resolved for us. And I think that you can see that there has been, I think you can see in contemporary events, a backlash against some of that worldview that Britain has had a negative impact that has led to a lot of people saying, actually, Britain is, you know, should be great. Like, kind of, why are we talking about the negative things in much the same way as you sometimes see in the US? In the US, because there is, I think that the difference is there is less history in the US, hopefully a way that doesn't sound too patronizing. you don't have the breadth of history. So, whereas it's easy in Britain to kind of pull back to kind of the 15th or 16th century and be able to point to kings or rulers who we can say, actually, like, kind of, you know, they did some negative things, and it doesn't really impact us in the way that we think about ourselves. It's much harder to do that when we're talking about history that's 100 years ago, that's maybe 200 years ago, 250 years ago, and is really kind of the start of the United States history. In those cases, it's much more difficult to, because it's far more personal. And I think alongside that, because of the way America is currently arguably going through a period of reconstruction of its role in the world, but still very much a geopolitical high, it's hard to, in that position of being very powerful and very successful, look back and say, actually, the way that we got here was through potentially negative means.
Hegemony doesn't lead to a lot of self-reflection.
Exactly, yes. So I think that part of the reason that Britain, it took decolonization and the end of empire, was that Britain actually was able to say, hey, look, we're not in a good place right now. We can be more reflective about how we got to the place that was good for us, but maybe wasn't as good for other people. And there was more pushback then. Obviously, like, decolonization, along with it came a narrative of, well, why is it that some of these colonies don't want us there? Mm-hmm. Why does India believe that actually the British people are not helpful to them? Why do they want freedom from us? Well, we have to actually examine some of the stuff that we have told ourselves about the way that we've ruled India. I don't think that the US is in a position to do that at the moment. And with that comes the idea of creating heroes. I think that one of the things that I have definitely found with teaching American history, far more than I think I have in World Civ or teaching any other classes, is that American students very much understand that certain presidents are good presidents and certain presidents are bad presidents. And there is very little nuance within that. And I think that that's partly a failing of history education within the United States, but worldwide, because history as a subject, as a discipline, is something that requires a very different skill set to most other disciplines. It requires both awareness of facts and awareness of kind of what the context was, but also interpretation. I was trying to think about this a little bit in the lead up to talking to you guys, and I really am struggling to find another discipline that has both of those in quite such an even balance. You know, something like studying English literature, you might have a lot of interpretation in there, but you don't necessarily have to know all the facts behind who the author was, why they were writing this, the context in which they were writing this. Obviously, it might be helpful for something like Jane Austen writing Pride and Prejudice to know the society that she was coming from, but you could definitely just read the book and make your own interpretations. You can't do that with history. You can't look back at someone like Martin Luther King without looking at the events that have shaped him and the events that are happening in the context. And then reading his work, you can't take that outside of the fact that interpretations will be made of what he has to say, of what he was doing. The reason I bring up MLK is because he is a figure that has been turned into a hero in American history. And so when we have conversations around race, quite often this comes up that, you know, well, we had the civil rights movement, we had leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., we had these kind of big changes that took place with the Equal Rights Act. And so, you know, this kind of sets it all in this context of history has moved on from there. And quite often you will see then people say, well, look, like kind of, you know, you have the Black Lives Matter movement now, but why aren't they acting in the civilized manner that Martin Luther King acted? Like kind of, why can't it just be about dialogue?
Because nobody can live up to the imagined status of that hero, like, right?
Yeah, but MLK at the time was not seen in that manner.
Right.
That is something that we have constructed around him as a historical narrative.
And added backwards.
Exactly.
I even remember that recently Jackie Kennedy's personal audio tapes or something were released, or were published, I think, even by her family. And one of the big deals with it was some of her critical comments about Martin Luther King Jr. And it was kind of interesting to think, well, you've got somebody who's living during the same lifetime and actually aware of some things going on behind the scenes saying these critical comments. For me, it wasn't like the thing that, you know, should somehow bury Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy in America, but it does kind of complicate it in ways, right? Where we realize, man, if I had been there at the moment, some of the ways that we have canonized and turned these folks into saints, in some ways, as a biblical studies person, it's a reminder to me that, like, that's the problem with turning this into a hagiography, where all of the things that we deem were the good things become the center of their memory, when in reality, it's actually a lot better for us, both historically and even in terms of biblical studies, to remember these people as complicated individuals with messy lives. To me, that's actually more encouraging and actually highlights some of the good that they did even better than to just kind of constantly highlight the singularly good things that they've done.
Absolutely. So Martin Luther King had a 72% disapproval rating in the last poll that was conducted before he was assassinated. Wow. 72% of Americans believed that he was trying to destroy America. I think that it's worth us remembering that at the time, he was deeply unpopular, in particular with white Christians, who believed that his work was disruptive, who believed that the issue of racial justice or racial reconciliation had already been resolved, that this was moving us forward in the wrong direction. And those are all things, those are all claims that are made today about racial justice movements. And so as we think about issues like the killing of Ahmaud Arbery and multiple other African-Americans who have been killed in similar circumstances over the past few years, and as we think about the movements that those have started, it is worth recognizing that whilst these are singular events, they do fit into a longer historical pattern. And I think that it's not just the students that I teach, but Americans as a whole are in some ways pretty ignorant about some of the ways that the arguments being used now have been used in the past to basically provoke opposition to racial justice throughout history.
So James, earlier in the conversation, you were talking about how there are these apparent major gaps in Americans' understanding of our racial history. Are there some resources that you would recommend for somebody wanting to fill in those gaps?
Yeah, there are a couple of books that I can definitely recommend. One of these books actually is one that you have recommended to me in the past, Stephen, which is Lies My Teacher Told Me by James Loewen.
Oh, James Loewen.
Yeah. And there's James Loewen has a few books that are very good. The other one that I think that you have recommended to me as well is Sundown Towns.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you a brief overview of what those are about, Lies My Teacher Told Me is James Loewen's exploration of history textbooks that are used in high school and how they omit or at the very least dial back a lot of the negative aspects of American history. It goes through a few subjects and talks about how those textbooks basically really overlook very, very important parts of the overall story and narrative in favor of presenting the best possible face. And it also talks a little bit about why that is. And I think that that's also an important thing for people to know, is that
it has to do with like the outsized influence of certain states in textbook curriculum.
Exactly. And that there are vested interests that actually, in some cases, don't want you to know some aspects of American history because it is either inconvenient or they don't believe that it is relevant. Sundown Towns, by comparison, is a single subject, and it is the issue of Northern racism. One of the things that I can often find when I'm teaching is that students believe that racism was something that the South had and that the North didn't. And that with the end of the Civil War, the South was kind of purged of its racism, and that like kind of then moving forward, there were still Southern strongholds of racism, but the North generally was the nice, good side that didn't have any racism. Sundown Towns really kind of dismantles that idea and talks about how racism is a broader thing. The second set of resources that I would recommend are specifically a more Christian resource. Loewen's work is very, very valuable, but is absolutely from a secular standpoint. Two books that I would recommend, again, both by the same author, Jim Wallace, are God's Politics and America's Original Sin. God's Politics is more of a way of looking at the contemporary world as it is now from a Christian perspective and examining whether, when we talk about engaging with the world through a Christian lens, what we really mean is taking a Christian lens and filtering it through partisan political leanings. The second book, however, America's Original Sin, is again more about history. It is about, its subtitle is Racism, White Privilege, and the Bridge to a New America. And it is a very concise and enjoyable read, if there can be one, about America's racial history from a Christian perspective, why it matters that racism still exists today, and why we should be engaging with that as an issue and a topic.
Well, this has been a really good conversation. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, thank you. Me too.
I really appreciate you spending time with us this morning.
No problem at all. I appreciate being asked. And yeah, anytime you want to chat more about history, I am always happy to do so.
It's good having you on today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. Also, it's just fun.
Yeah, I agree. I've missed these chats, Stephen.
That was really fun having James on.
It was great. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to get to know James as much over the years while he's been at Crown, so it's cool to be able to talk with him.
Yeah, I think the whole issue of, like, one of the things, so he mentioned James Loewen's texts, and one of the things that Loewen talks about is how the 1920s were actually a low point of American race relations. And sometimes I think we think about, you know, kind of this constant upward trajectory. And yeah, so those gaps that he was talking about make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I thought his points about how America makes these heroic figures and then we look back on them with just this sort of blind sense of the goodness that they did is really fascinating. I mean, I know that's been such a part of my experience in American history. I think back on like I can't remember a bad thing ever being said about Abraham Lincoln. Not that I'm aware of any, you know, like, but it's just interesting because I internally revolt against when that happens in theological circles. So when we hear about a figure, you know, either a biblical figure and or, you know, a person who was some heroic Christian in the past, I revolt when those people are made out to be saints in ways that make them feel unrelatable to the average human being. And I remember when I was at Crown, I read a biography of A.B. Simpson, and I really disliked it. It was, you know, the founder of the Christian Missionary Alliance. Mm-hmm. And I really despised it because it made it seem like everything he ever did was good. And when I heard more about the fact that he was actually a complex figure with a lot going on in his life, I thought, well, now that's actually a good story. Why didn't anybody tell that? And maybe someone has now, but the one that I read didn't do that. And to me, it's so frustrating because I naturally gravitate towards historical figures who have those heroic aspects, but who have dark moments, because I feel like now that's a person I can relate to. So in some ways, we do a disservice in history by making them out to be these singular figures, when actually there's something to gravitate towards and realizing, man, there are average human beings who have the same problems we do, who accomplish pretty, you know, significant things.
And there's this risk too that two risks that come to mind. One is that when you find some dirt on one of these heroes, you either have to dismiss it to maintain the narrative, or the hero becomes less of a hero, right?
Yeah.
And so you can, and then so some people will use that cynically to, you know, dig up dirt on somebody because obviously it's there because they're human.
Yeah.
You know, and they lose that hero status, you know, as a way to try to change the narrative. But the other thing is, I think we risk missing the good that is present now because nobody's measuring up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think even just, it's interesting to think about. So seeing Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, those are the ones I'm mostly aware of. I remember earlier presidents, but those four, like that happening, right? People trying to figure out, okay, is this one a villain or a hero? You know? And then once they're cast in that die, it's like there's no way to get them back out. And of course, every one of them is complicated.
Yeah. So maybe the danger's in making anyone a hero in some ways, right? I think about some of the recent stuff that's come out about Jean Vanier and how disturbing those reports have been. And it's been difficult to reflect back on, well, some of what he said about the value of all human beings and certainly in his context of dealing with folks with severe disabilities, I think to myself, like, that's still as true as it ever was. And yet you can't help but think it still clouds it with a certain sense of sadness when you think about some of the things now that have come out about him.
Isn't that true?
Should we still look, should we still read him? Should we still take value from what he has to say? Should we still even commend some of the great things he did say in that circumstance? Yes. In the same sense, like, we can't turn a blind eye to what we're now finding out. And I mean, it's that way with really any historical figure.
And we definitely can't give that stuff a pass just because he said these other things that are well stated.
Absolutely not. Yeah, that's the complexity of it. So, I mean, it's so difficult in dealing with real human beings. In some ways, it's so much easier for us just to maintain this facade of their heroism without ever exploring some of the darkness of these figures. I like it when I come to the realization that people I've looked up to in history have flaws. Of course, there's a certain sense of comfortability with the kinds of flaws that we accept, though, right? Like, So, you know, if some really egregious, brutal things were done, it really makes it difficult to look up to people at all. But to some extent, I like the balance of the real human being who's able to accomplish incredible things. That feels like there's hope for me because I know my own humanity and I know my own weaknesses.
Yeah. And if we hold ourselves to that hero standard, I mean, and I think that that's even part of the issue with understanding the gospel, right? Like, Jesus isn't like, hey, I'm going to bring you into the kingdom if you got it all together, right? Like, that's the whole thing, is like, you don't have it together. Let me give you the righteousness you don't have. Let me give you the fullness that you don't have. And I want to do some good things through you, but it's not because you're a hero, right?
No
it's
kidding.
Not because, you know, it's not because you don't have some character flaws. Like the whole entrance point is acknowledging our character flaws, yeah. is acknowledging our inability to make things right. And,
yeah, it's what bothers me about calling Acts, the book of Acts, the Acts of the Apostles. And of course, there's reasons for doing that, but it makes it seem like this is the story of these heroic early Christian figures, when actually right. the story, the narrative, whether you're tracing Paul or Peter or any of the other folks in the narrative, it's far more complicated than just a story of heroism. And so that's part of the difficulty there. Well, this is a fun conversation. I really enjoyed having him on.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for episode 7 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.